And that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to. That one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble and drum. Beat out old trouble and drum. Beat out old trouble and drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Kick him 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 out the door.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR. This program is streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast, and the world's greatest producer. I've just seen her do extraordinary things, the type of things you can only dream about in life. What? I can't believe it. You're here? I can't believe how quick you were, how you organised the guest, you put on the song. You're extraordinary. What can I say? I'm humbled. Humbled.
Shall I bring the guest in?
Bring Greg in, and we'll see what happens. Grigori. Are you on the phone?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you, that's the main thing.
Oh, good.
Well, look, you were on the show about 18 months ago.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah, what did we talk about?
Oh, probably our neighbour.
Our neighbour?
Neighbourly business, yes. Indonesia, Papua.
Now, Greg, you've written a book, a new book.
Well, yes, manuscript. It's taking shape, yes.
What, you haven't finished?
No, I've sort of finished it. I'm just looking around now to might be the best area publisher to get it to the public.
Right. I can't guess what it's about. What's it about?
Well, I did find some interesting details about early Indonesian history, how the western half of New Guinea became part of Indonesia.
Right.
And it's it surprised me, actually, because I'd interviewed the Japanese fellow, Nishijima, who really organised it. He convinced President Sukarno to include West New Guinea as part of Indonesia, but they kept it very quiet. And it didn't really become a problem for... That was 1945.
Right.
It didn't become a problem until 49, really, until the Dutch kept New Guinea and handed over sovereignty of Indonesia. Well, the Indies became Indonesia. But what I found was there were three very prominent Indonesians, like the deputy president, Hatta, the first foreign minister, or one of the first, Agus Salim, and the Prime Minister, Sultan Syariah, all three top people said, no, do not include West New Guinea as part of New Indonesia,
Right.
So it's there very...
How did you find that out? Is that in the records?
It's from on official records in the archives in Jakarta.
So what, you access the... Are they digitalised, or do you have to go to Jakarta to access it?
Well, I've been twice over there, actually, in the last six months or a year. It's the official record of the debates that took place under the Japanese, under Nishijima, before independence, before the proclamation of independence in 17th of August 1945.
Right.
And 60 or so Indonesian nationalists used to gather around, and Nishijima would conduct, debates and conversations, and he formed a group to teach them how to look after the new country, run the new country to be Indonesia.
That's unusual for the Japanese, wasn't it?
Well, he was Navy, you see. He was he was a Navy agent, I suppose. But he wasn't... The army, Indonesian army, and the Japanese army, the Japanese Navy, weren't quite eye to eye, you know. So the Japanese Navy was thinking ahead, whereas the army was a bit every day, you know, looking after crises every day.
I didn't think it was the Japanese policy to encourage local anti-colonial movements.
They promoted it.
They did promote it, right?
Just they were the midwife, really.
Right. I've been led astray.
Again.
Well, I'm always led astray, Greg Paul Green. I'm always led astray. So the Indonesian Imperial Forces. This is during World War II. We're very, very keen to Indonesia to become an independent sovereign nation state and break away from the colonial Dutch.
Yeah, well, the Japanese Navy were very keen. They're looking ahead.
Right.
They put people in to Bandung. This is before the war started. You know, they had Japanese agents working secretly. I mean, Nishijima was brought into the Netherlands, he's in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
And his friend Yoshizumi was, they're spies, Japanese spies. They were the two top spies.
Right.
And both of them helped the Indonesian nationalists prepare for independence.
So where did Sukarno come in all this?
Well, he'd been operating since 20-year-old, you know, and he'd been... Probably the most prominent Indonesian in the 20s. And in the early 30s, he was put into exile by the Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Hatta and Sharia, who were sent to West New Guinea, Bougainville, for 1 year, Sukarno went to Flores, where the Komodo dragons are.
Yep.
But he spent 1 year there, and I think he said he didn't like it very much, so they put him over to Sumatra, near... in a southern area of Sumatra on the Indian Ocean coastline. Yeah, and so, he was there when the Japanese came. He was there, and they brought him over after 2 or 3 months, and they basically put him in the top position, and he benefited very much from the Japanese, from Nishijima, in fact, because he was taken around and basically given Japanese, pro-Japanese things to say to all the villages far and wide. And that's where a lot of the Javanese villages were Sukarno was speaking on loudspeakers, you know.
Right.
And those Japanese used to put the loudspeakers up in the trees. And they'd never seen this before, so they used to refer to the singing trees, you know.
Right, his
voice in the trees, basically. And that's one of the reasons, I think, how Sukarno became so well known. It was during the Japanese period.
Mm-hmm.
But he was definitely one of the top, the top speaker, you know, the public speaker. He was quite gifted in that respect.
Right.
But there were 2 or 3 others... of similar caliber, but at the end of the war, the Indonesian nationalists, 66, I think they were, meeting under the Japanese, they decided, okay, Sukarno will be president, and Hatta, Muhammad Hatta, who was Dutch-trained lawyer, he was the best legal brain amongst the nationalists.
Mm-hmm.
He became deputy vice president, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a few others were picked. But the interesting thing I found was Hatta, Sukarno, and one other person who was sort of the MC of this nationalist meeting, they were taken up to Saigon, where the top Japanese commander was. This is 1 week before the Japanese surrendered, right?
Right.
They were taken up there, and his name was Toruchi, right? And they flew up, and he said, look, we've promised you Indonesians independence, and we were going to give you this territory and this territory and this territory. You know, they're talking about Malaya,
yep.
the Philippines,
yep.
East Timor. You know, he's going to throw in all this territory. But he said, sorry, we can't do it because we've been defeated.
Right.
And they've just dropped this huge bomb
Hiroshima and Nagasaki, yeah.
Well, he hadn't dropped the second one then, but he said, look, it's just right. so huge. We have to surrender. We have to surrender very quickly.
Right.
And we cannot interfere with the surrender process because the Russians just declared war on Japan as well. Mm-hmm. And they're racing across the top. And I think they killed 60,000 Japanese in 1 week.
Yes.
And they're heading down another week, they'd be in Tokyo.
Right.
So they had to surrender cleanly, quickly, and don't have anything to interfere with that surrender. And that is why when Nishijima and Sukarno declared independence, they did not mention West New Guinea, Netherlands, New Guinea, because if they'd included Netherlands, New Guinea in their proclamation of independence, it would have been a problem because, I mean, General MacArthur was already occupying the territory, you know, halfway to the Philippines.
Yes.
And so they didn't want anything to interfere with it, so they didn't mention it. But I'm sure they genuinely included it. But because Nishijima knew what West New Guinea contained in terms of natural resources, you know, Sukarno didn't. Sukarno didn't know about the oil or the gold, the copper. He just wanted it because Nishijima offered it to him. He wasn't going to get Malaya. He wasn't going to get the Philippines or anything like that. So he said, oh, well. And I asked Nishijima, because I interviewed him in his house in Tokyo in 1983, I said, what was Sukarno's reaction when you offered him West New Guinea? And Sukarno said, oh, well, if you want to give it to us, we'll take it. Thank you, you know. That was it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's exactly what Nishijima said. You know? If you want to give it to us, we'll take it. Because they really wanted Malaya.
Right.
They wanted to get control of the Malacca Straits, you know, one of the busiest waterways in the world, you know.
Mm.
And that's what the Indonesian was good business.
Could you explain to give us a thumbnail sketch? We've got a fair bit of time. Of the Dutch occupation of Indonesia and how they took it off the Portuguese and when all this occurred?
Well, they took it off the Indonesians, basically. Well, the Portuguese arrived first.
Yep.
Portuguese arrived, well, they took Malacca, you know,
mm-hmm.
1511. And the interesting thing there is that I didn't realise Magellan, you know, we all know Magellan because
yes.
he sailed around the world first.
Mm.
He was in that. The first attempt to capture Malacca, it was about 2 years earlier. He was part of that attempt. Then he went back to Portugal. But in 1511, Portuguese Albuquerque came again and they captured Malacca.
Right.
And then they basically after spices and gold. And within a few months, they'd sent three ships, caravels, over towards the Spice Islands. You know, we know that over towards the coastline of New Guinea, actually, that's where they are. And one of them got to New Guinea. The other two got with the Banda Islands and they went back with some spice.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them, Sarau, his name was Francisco Sarau, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first Portuguese or the first European to go to New Guinea and to look out and see the huge Pacific Ocean from the western side. We all know about Balboa on, you know, in Mexico, looking out. He named it the Pacific, I think.
Mm.
It was about the same time it was. But Sarau was the first man on the outside, the
right.
Australian side of the Pacific. Yeah?
Mm.
And he was a friend of Magellan. And when he saw this vast amount of water and he realised gold, the gold that they were seeking had been coming from New Guinea for centuries and centuries.
Right.
It had been traded from New Guinea. We didn't know that. We still don't really know that. But a report, well, he got Magellan basically to go around the world, to sail around the world he inspired him to sail around the world. And he, as you probably know, Magellan was killed in the Philippines.
Yes.
And Sarau was killed. Well, yeah. He died, naturally.
Yeah. Now, people think of these as huge ships. They were basically, what, about 90 people on the ship?
Tiny
little ships, yeah.
In fact, when those three Portuguese ships left Malacca and were heading towards the Spice Islands, they were in the Java Sea, and they coming towards them, they saw these huge Papuan war canoes.
Right.
With about 120 people in each canoe. The war canoes were longer than the Portuguese boats. Can you believe it?
Yes, yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So they went left, right, and didn't want to engage the Papuans. They said it looked far too dangerous. In fact, when the Portuguese finally landed in Ternate Tidore, the sultans there asked for help from the Papuans, and they sent over 60 of these big war canoes, and they defeated the Portuguese. Can you believe it?
Mm.
The first time, I think, Papuans were so fierce, but they until the Portuguese brought cannon, then the Papuans were forced back.
Right.
But the Portuguese commander wrote in his diary, he's never seen people fight like this before. He said the dead ones were the lucky ones.
Right.
That's pretty severe.
Well, that is severe. Yes.
But basically, cannon. Right. Portuguese won with the cannon, and they forced the Papuans back, and then. In 1581, well, just when Portugal was about to be taken over by Spain, that very year they had a union of crowns, they call it,
mm-hmm.
and Spain took over Portugal, basically. 1581, there was a Portuguese commander, navigator. His name was Rosso de Brito, and he was just on the far westerly edge of New Guinea where the nose of the bird is, if you imagine New Guinea Island like a bird, He's going around this air, and he wrote this report in Portuguese. Because it was Spanish, Spain had taken over, the Portuguese report ended up in Manila, was translated into Spanish, and there it stayed for 400 years, hidden, lost, whatever you like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
It was translated into English only 30 years ago, and that's the report I'm talking about. So in that report, Rosso de Brito was talking about gold in abundance. In the far westerly reaches of New Guinea, the Papuans were bringing alluvial gold down from the highlands and trading it, and Papuans were trading furiously in gold, and the gold would make its way up to Malacca and off around the world market.
Mm.
They also traded nutmeg. They had nutmeg as well.
Right.
But the gold, I should say, I'm just going to say, Rosso de Brito found one island with 5,000 merchants, and he described them all rich with gold. That gives you an idea how much gold was around.
Right.
But where did the gold go? Because it wasn't there when the Dutch came. I think it's probably still waiting to be discovered in the Manila archives in the Philippines. I think around 1600, there were two military expeditions, Spanish military expeditions. They don't say publicly that they went down and they stole all the gold and killed people and, They just say they went to Ternate Tidore. That's it. But it's not too far away to go further south. And I think probably they took all the gold. This is exactly what they did in the Philippines. And I think it's highly likely they did it in West New Guinea too.
Right. So when did the Dutch appear on the horizon?
About then, about 1600, 1620,
mm-hmm.
they started coming in. And they didn't talk about gold. They were after spice, after nutmeg,
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest problem facing the Dutch was the fact that even though there was rich nutmeg in Banda Islands and the Spice Islands, the problem for them was that the Papuans also grew nutmeg. So what they did was give cannon to the sultans of Ternate Tidore and told them to keep these Papuans back, make them isolate them, keep them separate, So because they did manage to do that for about 150 years, 200 years even, 16 to 1800, yeah. So the Dutch got this amazing spice monopoly, you know, the monopoly on nutmeg. And that's what made the VOC, the Dutch East Indies Company, the richest company in the world. Mm. And that's what made Amsterdam the financial capital of the world for 150 years. Mm. It's quite remarkable.
So was there military engagement between the Dutch and the Spanish Portuguese?
Oh, yeah, they're fighting most of the time.
In that area, they were fighting most of
it. Right. All the time, yeah, all the time. Fighting over nutmeg.
No.
And in 1660, I think, the Spanish fled, and the Portuguese with them.
Mm.
And then the Dutch just took over.
Right.
But they didn't take over Java then. They took over the Spice Islands.
Right.
And in around 1800... The British were moving, well, the French were there all the time. The British moved in, and the British ruined or destroyed their monopoly.
Right.
So that's when the Dutch moved over to Java, and they grew all sorts of crops in Java, and it became their main base, Java.
Right.
And then they moved up to Sumatra over the next 100 years. You know.
So was the area? Did they have a common language, the area?
No, well, market Malay Bahasa, Indonesia today, has grown out of what they used to call market Malay. You know, it's the market language.
Right, right.
But originally, there were hundreds of different languages, you know.
Right.
People say there are hundreds of languages in Papua. Well, there were hundreds of languages between Papua and the top of Sumatra as well. But and even today, I mean, I've just returned a week ago from Indonesia, and the area where I was living in, which is around Malang, I mean, they speak Bahasa, yes, but they also speak three or four other languages. Sometimes there'll be two or three languages in the one sentence. You know?
Right.
That's my excuse for not being fluent.
So how did the Portuguese kind of maintain East Timor for so long?
Wow, it was the backwater, wasn't it?
Nobody was interested. No gold.
No, not really. No, they had sandalwood and nothing. But Portuguese were really remarkable. They were ferocious fighters. It was interesting. I read a report from one Portuguese commander after fighting the Papuans. They captured a 13-year-old Papuan, son of a chief, I think, and the Portuguese commander wanted to interview him, wanted to interrogate him. So they brought him in. As the Portuguese soldiers were bringing him in, you know, they were standing up along the hallway, and, you know, they had the guards with their big swords and their helmets and whatever. Suddenly this young Papuan, he must have been quite strong, but he pulled a sword out of one of the scabbards and started killing Portuguese soldiers. You know, he killed three or four before they stopped him. He's just so fierce a fighter.
Mm.
And they pinned him up against the wall with their lances and said, "Stop, stop, stop, we don't want to kill you. Our commander wants to speak with you." You know, but he wouldn't stop. He wouldn't stop fighting, so they killed him.
Yeah.
Which, that gives an idea of what the Portuguese were like. They were really ferocious. They said they'd never... Unless you'd seen the fighting, you wouldn't believe it, he said. Yeah.
Right.
And this is
now getting back to these West Papua and Indonesian islands.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Obviously, in West Papua and the rest of New Guinea, you had these traditional groups. Now, you talked about sultans. Is this the
Islam
period
arrived,
before when the Arab traders came? Or
no, well, Islam arrived about 60, 80 years before Christianity arrived.
Right.
So the Spanish, Portuguese in this case, they were sort of chasing them all the way from the Iberian Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
But it really only arrived a short time before Christianity arrived. And but Islam eliminated, finished the Hindu-Buddhist Majapahit regime, which is around, you know, the eastern end of Java, Surabaya.
Right.
But that sort of around that area, there was the big Majapahit Empire, which did trade with Malacca. Some people say it controlled Malacca, but it spread around up to Sumatra and Java. And one Indonesian nationalist, who was actually the advisor for Sukarno, his name was Muhammad Yamin, mm-hmm. he said Majapahit controlled not just the western part of New Guinea, but he said it controlled all of the island of New Guinea, right down to Port Moresby.
Right.
You know, like where Port Moresby is today.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence of that at all.
Well, there's no archaeological evidence, is there?
No. He was a little bit, he was a poet and a...
Right.
So,
yeah, look, don't start me on poets. I've had enough trouble here at 3CR with poets. But now it's...
But he was quite influential.
Yes.
And Sukarno really believed him. But he settled just for West New Guinea.
So how many years have you been involved in this research? You're saying that you went to Japan in the mid-80s.
Yes, I interviewed Nishijima there in 83.
Yeah.
I suppose that's one of the things, I suppose, that got me interested, because he was such an interesting fellow. He became known as the godfather of Indonesia, partly because of what he did in, 17th of August 1945 with the Proclamation of Independence, but also because he got New Guinea for the Indonesians, but also because of what he did in the 1950s, so he kept on being active after the 50s. It's interesting for me that most people in Indonesia don't know Nishijima, can you believe it? They knew his commander, Admiral Maeda.
Mm-hmm.
When they read in the books, because he was the boss, he took part in planning the Japanese invasion south, but Nishijima was a bit lower down, but he's one of these people who do all the work but don't get the
draft horse. Draft horse, not show pony. Look, it's 4:29. We're having a little chat with Mr. Polgrain. Is it doctor or mister or professor these days?
Well, University of Malang have appointed me as adjunct professor.
Yeah, we need to give you, the honorifics deserve because of all the work you've done in that area. I mean, I'm actually learning things, and it's unusual for me to learn things,
Yes. No, well, Malang is the best place to hang out because of its elevation. I think it's cooler climate. It's not the hot, sweaty, like Jakarta's a bit uncomfortable, But Malang is much more habitable.
Right, it's 4:30. This is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. Kelly's producing the program. We're chatting, not interviewing, chatting with Greg Polgrain regarding his latest research regarding West Papua. Now, getting back to World War II, independence was declared. When did the Japanese surrender?
Well, August in... 45.
Yes, was it before?
It was really a matter of the bomb dropped and they had no way of answering it. So
they declared Indonesian independence after the bomb was dropped.
2 days.
Two days, right?
Oh well, not after the bomb. After the Japanese surrender was the
15th,
wasn't it?
Yes.
And I think that's another interesting historical point I've dug out of the archives, because as soon as the Japanese surrendered, there was a group of Indonesians, the younger group, the Pemuda. They were listening on the radio. They heard it. Japan had surrendered, and they declared they wanted Indonesian independence declared by Indonesia, not by Japanese sponsored. So they kidnapped Sukarno and Hatta.
Right.
And took them over about 15 kilometres away to another village nearby. And they were going to declare, but they would have included West New Guinea, Netherlands, New Guinea, you see. When they declared independence, And Nishijima didn't want that because he knew that would be stomped on by the Allies straight away. So he sent over his boss. That gives you an idea of the relationship between Nishijima and Maeda.
Mm.
But he sent over Maeda, Admiral Maeda, who talked with the young Indonesians, and he convinced them, yes, we agree, we'll declare independence as soon as we can, tonight or tomorrow morning. It was the following morning.
Mm-hmm.
But he got them back under the tutelage of Nishijima, see?
Right.
And Nishijima realized that if the Pemuda had declared independence, he would have lost control of New Guinea.
Right.
But when he declared independence the next morning, New Guinea wasn't mentioned.
Right.
Silence strategy.
Right. So how long was the conflict between the Dutch colonialists who attempted to retake Indonesia?
Well, the British, that's the interesting thing as well, because British came first. I was just reading a book, I'm still reading it actually, by Lawrence van der Post. He was the British top intelligence man there between 1945, and they were there to the end of 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to make sure that Malaya, the British colony nearby, didn't get mixed up, didn't get embroiled in the Indonesian Revolution. So this is why I contacted Lawrence van der Post when I was in London. I interviewed him and said, look, I've come across some interesting documents written by the American intelligence people, the OSS, the predecessor for the CIA they were, you know. And the OSS accuse you, sir, Lawrence van der Post was Charles's godfather, by the way.
All right, yes.
Yeah, I was arranging, anyway. And he said, no, you know, I didn't do that. You know, I accused him of basically, on the basis of what the Americans were saying in their report, that he had started a rumor in Sumatra, up around central Sumatra, which is very, very close with Malaya.
Yep.
And it's historically close, so that all the uncles and aunts, brothers and sisters, are all interrelated, just separated by 3 kilometres of Malacca Strait, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very strong movement in Malaya to join the Indonesian Revolution. But after van der Post spread a rumour that the Sultanate in Langkat was going to join the British and not take part in the revolution, the British released a whole lot of murderous people from prison, and they killed 300 of the royal family, the extended royal family, the elite, Kerajaan, they call them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when the people in Malaya heard that 300 of their relatives had been killed, they said, my God, you know, we don't want to take part in this Indonesian revolution. No, no thanks.
Right.
So that's what saved Malaya. Van der Post saved Malaya, and he got this big medal from the king, you know, a few years later.
So how long were the Dutch in Indonesia after the Declaration of Independence before they were?
Well, they fought. The Dutch moved in 1945 they caused a problem then. They were a little bit arrogant. And they just thought they would resume their colony. But there was no way they were going to do that because Indonesian nationalism was just exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And the British managed to keep it under control a little bit. 1946, they left, and then the Dutch took over full time. So 46, 47, 48, 49, the Dutch were forced out, Americans forced them out, saying, look, you leave, otherwise we'll stop your Marshall Plan in the funding for post-war reconstruction in Europe.
What happened to little West Papua?
What happened in West Papua?
No, what happened? It remained under Dutch control, did it?
Well, it was occupied in 1943, 1944 by General Douglas MacArthur.
Right.
And it was already occupied by the Dutch when the proclamation was made. It was already Dutch, you know, already American Dutch. And some of MacArthur's geologists stayed about 10 years after the war, checking out all the minerals and oil and gold and everything. So they hung around for some time, but basically it was Dutch. In the 1950s, it was this sovereignty dispute between the Netherlands and Indonesia, because they'd kept New Guinea and didn't include it as part of Indonesia when they handed over Indonesia in 1949.
Right. So what's Sukarno retaking an interest in West Papua?
Well, he declared that he included it in 1945, which I think he did, but he just didn't mention it by name, that's all.
So was there any historical association for a...
Well, they like to think so. They like to think Majapahit controlled all of New Guinea.
Right.
Which is... there's no historical basis for that whatsoever. Mm. They say the sultans of Ternate and Tidore controlled the Papuans. Mm. This is when I said they were given cannon by the... by the Dutch East Indies Company, you know, the DOC, they call it. Mm. They gave the two sultans cannon to suppress the Papuans so that the nutmeg wouldn't get mixed up with their nutmeg monopoly.
Right.
But that's just a very small area, you know. I mean, most Papuans then and today in West Papua live in the highlands, you know, 60% right. population live in the highlands. And it's cool, it's malaria-free, it used to be. But the number of people going up by a plane all the time tend to take malaria up now. But it used to be malaria-free, and the rivers were filled with gold. Whenever they wanted to get something, they'd collect a bit of alluvial gold and walk for 2 weeks. I did an expedition when I was over there in Nabire, which is sort of the back of the neck of the bird.
Right.
I went by four-wheel drive over a few mountain ranges.
So what year was this?
Oh, 2006 or something, you know.
Mm-hmm. So long after it had been...
To where the Papuans were collecting gold out of the river, you know. Mm. I had a gold expert with me, and he estimated just from this one big bend in the river, he said $40 million worth of gold was being panned out of there that they'd use... woks or something from the kitchen, you know, instead of gold, proper instruments.
Right.
But you could shake it, and get a bit of gold, and, you know, then normally you'd piece it together, put it in a matchbox or something, and you'd take the gold into the town Nabire, which is a day's travel away.
Mm-hmm.
But Indonesian intelligence group called Kopassus, they put an extra tax on people to come in to sell their gold, so they'd sell their gold where they were mining the gold in the river, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Kopassus used to come out and buy the gold from them. But the counterfeit money they used, it was all counterfeit notes.
Right.
They would buy gold with counterfeit notes.
Right. Now, I just want to get back to when West Papua was forcefully integrated into Indonesia. What was the driving factors that saw the Dutch removed?
The Dutch, just before World War II, they'd occupied colonially controlled, administered only 5% of Netherlands, New Guinea. 5%, it's ridiculous.
Right.
So in the 1950s, when Sukarno was claiming the Dutch had to leave, it was an anti-colonial campaign as though the Dutch controlled everything, you know, but they really only had 5% to start with.
Right.
So during the 1950s, the Dutch had to colonize New Guinea for the first time, really.
Mm.
They were frantically spending money colonizing New Guinea, building ports and hospitals, and in the 1950s, that's what they did, and educating the Papuans to try to say, we are going to bring self-determination for the Papuan people. You know?
Right.
But basically, the Dutch had their own future in mind, because this massive mountain of gold had been discovered in 1936. That's the biggest gold mine, biggest gold deposit in the world, up in the mountains in New Guinea. And that's why they kept New Guinea. That's why the Dutch maintained the Dutch presence in post-war Netherlands, New Guinea, because it had the biggest gold deposit ever found in the world. And that's the gold deposit that's really influenced Indonesian history, Papuan history, ever since 1936 when it was discovered, you know.
Yeah, it's the curse.
Yes, the curse. That's what I called it, West Papua's curse of gold.
Yeah. So how intensive is the integration of Papuan society into...
Well, they're now a minority in their own country. Yeah?
Right.
In fact, there was an academic forum yesterday in Jayapura, the capital, and they're basically saying, hey, what's happening? You know, we're a minority. And they've got, like, in the southern coastline, there's a place called Merauke, just near the PNG border, of something like 30 members of parliament there, only two are Papuan.
Right.
The rest are transmigrants from Java and Sulawesi.
Yeah.
But the main problem is, as they discussed yesterday in this academic forum, they're saying, oh, well, transmigrants are coming over and the population is reducing. True. I mean, people are coming over and settling, but that's not the main reason why Papuan's population has been decreased. You know? They should check up the 2005 publication, the Encyclopedia of Genocide.
Right.
And you'll see really some statistics there were published on what was happening in the first, from 1960 up to 2004, the decrease in the rate of population in West Papua is really shocking because you can get an idea of it. You can't really gain it unless you look at census figures.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2005 article in Encyclopedia of Genocide was a comparison of the rate of increase in Papua New Guinea with the rate of increase in West New Guinea.
Right.
And so when you transfer, because of the similarity in culture, family size, you know, and basically that gives you a very strong basis for comparison of East and West.
Because are we talking less than a million Papuans now in West Papua?
No. It's about the total population of West Papua, that's Indonesian plus Papuans, is about 6 million now.
Yeah, and the Papuans are?
And Papuans are less than half.
Less than half, right.
Whereas in Papua New Guinea, the population, they say, is 12, 13 million, possibly 14, 15 million. They're not quite sure.
Right.
But that gives you an idea that I wouldn't compare the two populations. One, PNG's always been had more people, more population.
Right.
It's the rate of increase in PNG that you can move across, transpose into West Papua, and from that rate of increase, you could get a figure that you could reasonably expect the population of West Papua should have been or should be. You know? And it shows in 2004... there was a population deficit of 1.3 million.
Right.
Now, that gives you an idea. Okay, you know, the medical background, epidemiological isolation.
Yes.
You know, but basically, they haven't had any contact with the West. In some areas, this was, particularly the southern areas. If they get the flu, it's enough to kill them. And I think probably half would be attributable to that problem, but there's a lot of deaths. You know, 1.3 million. My goodness, that's the same number as the Armenian genocide.
Yes,
but nobody mentioned genocide yesterday in the academic forum in Jayapura.
Right.
But I mean, that's really staring people in the face.
So, is this an active genocide in terms of government policy, or is it because the Indonesian military sees West Papua as its personal fiefdom and the government has minimal control?
Before the current tragedy in Gaza, before the killing there began, the previous year, 2022, was it? The number of deaths in West Papua, 732, was twice as many as the number of Palestinians killed that year.
Yes.
So that gives you an idea of what's going on in West Papua. You know, the army really are out of control, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think the government really are well with whether you can separate the two. It's another matter. But the army and the police, call them the security forces, huh?
Yes.
They don't really treat Papuans as Indonesian citizens, put it that way. The racism there has been full on since the 1960s, and that's the issue that has to be addressed in Jakarta.
Yes.
Because until something changes there, you won't get any decrease in the death toll. You know?
Well, why do you think there is such little interest, not just in Australian political circles, but in Australia itself, regarding the genocide that's been occurring in West Papua, which is 70 kilometres from the Australian mainland?
Yes, just on our northern doorstep.
Mm.
Well, you've got the biggest gold deposit in the world. You've got one of the biggest gas deposits in the world.
Mm.
It's actually, that's under BP, up in the Bird's Head.
Yep.
And they're accessing about a third of the gas that's available. That's why I say it's actually one of the... It's comparable to the big gas fields in deposits in Siberia.
Mm.
But they're getting quite a lot out now, but it's only one third of what is possible. Now, just a year ago, they discovered another huge gas oil deposit, mostly under sea, but also extending into the mainland of New Guinea as well.
Mm.
But it's just so rich in natural resources. You've got the richest oil ever found in the world. I mean, that was under, well, I mentioned Admiral Maeda before.
Yep.
During the war, he was in charge of that oil field, you know. That's why he knew what was there.
Mm.
And they knew the gold was there. That's why Nishijima got Sukarno to do what he did to include West New Guinea, because Nishijima didn't want West New Guinea in Dutch hands. It would be better in Indonesian hands.
Mm.
So that's why he did what he did.
Look, it is an extraordinary situation when you think about it. You know, just off our coastline, this has been going on for over 60 years, and it continues day in and day out. And we train their troops in counterinsurgency measures. We provide equipment.
Mm.
We provide security. And it's not mentioned, you know. It's the unmentionable word in the Australian Parliament.
Yes, well, 20 years ago, I remember speaking with various politicians in Canberra saying, yes, West Papua was never mentioned, but it's actually on everybody's, breath.
They
were aware of it then. I'm not sure they'd be talking about it now with so many other problems.
Mm.
But it is a huge problem in... Well, there has been a change, I should admit. There has been a change in Jakarta. And because the number of... Since that New Zealand pilot was kidnapped a year ago...
Right.
And Indonesian troops have gone over... They made one big effort to try to rescue him, but I think they lost so many troops. They lost 7 or 8, and then 15 or so ran off into the jungle. They've never been seen since.
Yes.
So you're looking at between 20 and 30 were killed.
Mm.
And this is causing people in Jakarta to sing again, because they've changed last week, I think it was, they changed the name. You know how for 30 years they've been calling them criminal gangs and wild, desperate gangs.
That's right, yes, yes.
And never by their own Papuan term, the OPM.
Yes.
Which is the, freedom struggle, they basically translated it.
Yes.
But now, last week, apparently the army, head of the army, but it's not a government policy yet, I read.
Mm.
It's army policy to refer to them as OPM.
Right.
Which is like...
Well, it acknowledges,
an improvement. I think it's an improvement.
Well, it acknowledges they are a force to be reckoned with as far as Indonesian
interests are concerned. Yes, and they're struggling, nothing, for independence.
Yes.
Much the same way as the Indonesian nationalists were struggling for independence against the Dutch. It's very hard to get people. Some people in Jakarta just refuse to recognise that. For example, I heard a podcast by Dewi Fortuna Anwar, who used to be President Habibie's advisor back in 24 years ago.
Mm.
So, and she was saying, Indonesia supports the Palestinian people.
Right.
Not because of the link, the religious link.
Yes.
It's because the Palestinians deserve self-determination and independence.
Yes, but not the West Papuans.
Yes.
When do you think, we've got about 2 minutes, when do you think this book's going to be published?
Well, I hope before November, because November's going to be when the United Nations inquiry into the into the crash that caused the death of Dag Hammarskjöld. Mm-hmm. That's going to be released in November, and hopefully my assistants there should throw some light on it. It may not, but hopefully it will, and that will highlight the whole case of West Papua, because I'm saying Dag Hammarskjöld was killed because he was about to intervene and declare West Papuans independent in 1961.
Yes.
That's one.
Do you think you're going to have any trouble actually getting it published?
Well, I have experienced some trouble already.
Well, yes, that's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah,
because a lot of the university presses are very hesitant these days to publish anything that's of any consequence, I've noticed.
Well, some people are a little bit too careful, I think.
Yeah.
There's nothing all that new in it. It's just it's just dealing with a sensitive topic, and that's what I'm saying. Jakarta is becoming more open to debate. I actually gave a talk in the top Jakarta-based research institute, and on the topic of Papua.
Yes.
And then I was invited to give a talk, which is highly unusual.
So maybe things are changing.
Mm. No, yeah, they're changing. They're changing, they need to change faster.
Much faster. Well, Greg Polgrain, thank you very much for sharing all that extraordinary knowledge you've collected over a lifetime. And all I can say is it's been a privilege talking to you. And hopefully you'll contact us once the book is published, because we'd love to have a good look at it and have another chat to you at some stage.
Interesting. New details in the book.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
All the best. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.